All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Always a pleasure having you here. Henrik with Red Ice TV, and today we have a guest returning to the show, Julian Langness. He's been with us before. Last time he was with us, we were talking about his book, Fist Fights with Muslims in Europe, One Man's Journey Through Modernity. It was actually published 2016. I was almost saying last year, but it's the year before last. And also he had an essay titled The Coming War in Europe, Essays on Europe's Impending Destabilization and Internal Confrontation with Islam. And of course, Julian is, he was born in America, but I believe he has some Norwegian roots, among others. So he's, of course, very interested in the European question along with America in terms of what's going to happen. But Julian, welcome back. Good to have you here again.
Absolutely. Yeah, glad to be back, Henrik. Thank you.
Awesome. So you have a new book out of we're going to dive into today and talk more about. The title of this is Identity Rising, How Nationalist Millennials Will Retake Europe, Save America, and Become the New Greatest Generation. So give us a little bit backdrop on the book in terms of how it came together, why you wanted to write it.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story for what catalyzed it in my mind. But you're probably familiar with Strauss and Howe, who wrote all those generations books about the different generations and Strauss Howe generation theory. And a couple of years ago, I was listening to an interview. I think it was Brett McKay at artofmanliness.com was interviewing, I think it was Howe. And one of their books is all about how the millennials will be the, you know, the next great generation that kind of positively affects things or kind of saves things in their respective countries, or especially in America. And McKay was kind of grilling him on, well, what, you know, what do you think millennials could do that would be great? Like what could end up defining their generation? And he was just utterly at a loss. He had no idea what to say. He couldn't really think of anything positive about, you know, millennials or what they might be able to contribute or how they'll fit in the future of America, the West, et cetera. But I was kind of watching it and thinking to myself, you know, that it was really clear what that will be. And I think that hopefully, and obviously the title of the book's a little optimistic, but hopefully our generation will end up being remembered for kind of going against the baby boomer liberalism that's become the dominant orthodoxy in the West today. And hopefully, at least to some extent, bringing America and Canada and Western Europe back from the very, very unfortunate trajectory they're on right now. So that's basically what the book's about, is sort of the generations in America and Western Europe over the last 60 years, the massive changes that have resulted from those more progressive baby boomers, which is most of the baby boomer generation, coming to power in the West, especially what's going on in Europe, but also America. I'd say it's focused on both Western Europe and America. And then sort of our generation, the millennials, what it was like growing up within that paradigm of sort of far left baby boomer progressivism and sort of this movement that we're all a part of, you know, turning against that and trying to, you know, preserve the West, whether that's in a really kind of identitarian type of way or even, you know, with more kind of mainstream conservatives who also are kind of rebelling against that progressivism, cultural Marxism, et cetera. And then the latter third of the book is about what might come next and what things could look like over the next 20, 40 years in Western Europe and America, and whether and how we might be successful in averting what looks like it could be pretty tragic circumstances in Western Europe and Canada, America, a lot of the West.
Yeah, definitely. I do want to pick your brain on that. It's always interesting talking about the future and the potentials of what might be coming. And, of course, the reason for that is because many of us are well, we're dot connectors, really. We're trying to predict. We're looking at the statistics. We're looking at the numbers, trying to figure out, you know, what direction is this going to go if this continues, looking at trends and stuff like that. And I think that there's many of us on our side, if you will, that are much better at predicting what's coming than the liberals. I think they're completely naive on this question. Some might know what they're doing, and some might even subconsciously know that this is leading to the slow death and destruction of the West, and I think many of them are in fact happy about that. But, you know, again, that's kind of a distinction. Those who are knowingly doing what they're doing, and then those who are just going along with it because it's the easier way out. It feels the best. This is the narrative of the culture, etc. So, but let's save that a little bit in terms of the future and where this might go. Talk to us a bit about how you see millennials, because I mean, obviously, when I look at that, it looks like a kind of a hopeless generation in many regards. But then I'm hearing contradictory information about how they're turning towards conservatism, that they're sick and tired of the liberal BS that they have been brought up on, and they are to a certain extent rebelling. I don't know. I see, you know, when I look at things like the national walkout day, right? The school, how they co-opted the schools. and use that for their own left-wing ideological purposes and their anti-gun kind of rhetoric and stuff like that. It looks like there's a lot of kids that are on their side, although they're a little younger than millennials, many of these kids. But nonetheless, I'm talking about, like, you know, the coming generations. What page are they on, and what's your signs of optimism in all of this?
Great question. Yeah, it's really interesting. So Strauss and Howe, who wrote those Generations books, which is sort of the structure that I based my newest book on, they define millennials as anyone born between, I think it was 1980 and 2004. So that'd be anybody between age, well, that'd be 14 and 38 today. So that would include, a lot of time we hear about, you know, well, Generation Y is looking to be more right wing, but I think really Generation Y would still be within the millennial generation, within the Strauss-Howe, you know, statistics. And I mean, it's all subjective and kind of made up, like what makes up a generation. But, that's kind of how I define the age range of millennials. And my thinking on it is that basically millennials, were the first generation in the West to wholly grow up within this paradigm of progressivism, cultural Marxism, etc. By 1980, I would say the left had basically achieved complete hegemony over the universities, certainly over the entertainment industry since long before then. I think the public school system, like I grew up in a very conservative Republican area in America, very rural, and even though the county I grew up in was like 80% Republican, the public schools were still enormously liberal. So I think that millennials grew up within that paradigm. They were indoctrinated with it. They were taught that, you know, masculinity was toxic, and taught about white privilege, and taught that we were from evil patriarchal countries that had done all this horrible stuff. And so I think it's normal that today, when a lot of people think of millennials, they picture the blue-haired millennial with the nose ring and the gender studies degree, you know, whining about this and that. But I don't think that's, or at least I hope that's not how the millennial generation will go down in history, because really I think that's more of a reflection of the kind of baby boomer 1960s, 68 or progressivism that they were indoctrinated with and raised within. So my hope and the idea that I kind of put forth in the book is that if you want to see, you know, what the millennial generation hopefully will end up getting remembered for, you would need to look at the phenomenons like Generation Identitaire in Europe. And this kind of big movement of young people, obviously the alt-right is one term that's been associated with it, but it seems like that term is sort of evolving now or disappearing to some extent. So I try not to really use that term in the book because it's so ambiguous and it could mean a bunch of different things, but whatever you want to call it, this kind of great big tent, great big phenomenon of people ranging all the way in the mainstream from someone like, you know, Steven Crowder, who's a pretty mainstream conservative, but he's still a young person who's opposed to progressivism and cultural Marxism, all the way on the opposite side to individuals like you or me, or even people, you know, willing to be even more kind of provocative or more outside the Overton window, and basically describe this phenomenon and this sort of rise over the last couple of years, you know, Hillary Clinton's alt-right speech, everything like that, Trump's presidency, or I should say Trump's campaign in the primaries, what's going on in Europe, etc. And then my hope is that, you know, 20 years from now, it'll be that phenomenon, that kind of thinking that is associated with the millennial generation. And I think that, you know, and obviously that intertwines with what the future could look like in America, Canada, Western Europe, which we can get into in a while. But that's kind of my thoughts on the millennial generation, is that the kind of classic gender studies, blue-haired cultural Marxism associated with it is a reflection of the indoctrination millennials were raised within, rather than something kind of organic and new that defines the millennial generation.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, when you look at boomers, we can get into that later, but I mean, obviously, to a certain extent, as every generation, they can be held responsible, but we also have, you know, manipulators. We have these the postmodern neo-Marxists that have, you know, pushed all these things. They took over the culture. They ended up dominating, but what they managed to succeed with boomers and those afterwards was kind of a rebellious spirit. It was going against the grain, against the establishment. When I look at many millennials, it looks like many of them have kind of sucked up the propaganda. They haven't really been that rebellious. They are following the rules, if you will, and the conditioning of the establishment, but they still think that they're outside of it and rebellious. Is that just a tactic, or are they just, I don't know, just are they not as rebellious as the previous generations, do you think?
I think that's a part of the ideology. I mean, I think one of the foundations that baby boomer progressivism is kind of built upon is this romanticization of youth and, you know, youth rebellion and transgression and all this stuff. And I should add really quick that obviously it's not like all baby boomers follow these beliefs. There's other baby boomers like, you know, all sorts of people that completely were against this and are fantastic.
Of course.
And agree more with us. So just to add that as a disclaimer, but I think that, it arises a lot from this 1960s stuff that they're so passionate and romantic about, and they make so many films and documentaries talking about these days, all the Peter Brokaw 1968 stuff. But I think there's this romanticization of youth and youth culture and transgression for the sake of transgression and everything like that. And I think that one of the reasons that arose in the 60s is because the baby boomers were born into the greatest prosperity in human history. You know, they were in this big baby boom in the post-World War II years where, you know, the rise of nuclear weapons had basically kind of temporarily ended war to some extent, at least giant wars like World War II, World War I. So they were born into really safe societies, you know, unbelievable prosperity. And I think that's what kind of ended up leading them to be able to embrace all this kind of utopian belief and everything along those lines. And, you know, attack what, you know, generation upon generation of their ancestors had done and believed in that actually allowed them to be here and allowed them to live in that prosperity. So today I think we still see that lingering. Like I saw something on Twitter earlier today. It was some, you know, trendy kind of hipster clothing shop in Manhattan, and they had this little kid mannequin wearing a shirt that said activist. And I thought it was just the perfect representation of this sort of philosophy of, you know, transgression for its own sake and liberalism and progressivism. And now it's almost manufactured, like these school walkouts going on across the country about the NRA or guns or school shootings or whatever. I mean, it's, you know, that's the least organic thing in the world. I mean, it's obviously not really it doesn't have anything to do with youth or transgression. It has to do with the teachers union and the Democratic Party and, you know, big organizational capacity and pre-planned this and pre-planned that. Same thing, and one thing that I mentioned in the book and that I mentioned in my speech at Ameren last year is there was a really, what I thought was a really hilarious moment a couple years ago where Green Day, you know, that 1990s punk rock band, they were performing at some, you know, award show and they chanted that, you know, Trump, fascist, USA, KKK thing. I don't remember how it went, but, you know, it's so ironic because here's this bunch of 50-something dudes pretending to be this youthful, transgressive band. They're all multimillionaires. They're singing a message that is perfectly congruent with their billionaire corporate record label bosses. It's like the least transgressive or rebellious thing in the world, but that idea of transgression and rebellion and progress and everything else and utopianism has been commodified and sort of sacralized to such an extent within this philosophy that it's now almost a cliche, like a running joke, you know? But the real transgression is the people, you know, like you and Lana and all the people in Europe, you know, Brittany Pettibone, Martin Selner, who are actually offering new ideas, unique ideas, and actually suffering for it. That's the transgression today. As a lot of people said, the new counterculture is of the right. It's extremely easy to be a doctrinaire liberal progressive in this day and age. It's actually hard not to be. So I think that really things have just kind of undergone a 180 degree turn, and I'm hopeful that, that things will continue evolving in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point, you know, because, yeah, there's always people getting, you know, manipulated. I see that, you know, by the establishment, by the culture, obviously, and they're being used as pawns in the game. And I was being interested in the questions like, well, I wonder if they were more prone to kind of fall for this propaganda the easier they had it growing up, right? That, as you said, prosperity is a part of it. To a certain extent, material success, right? I think this is why you used the subtitle on the book as well, right? Talking about the greatest generation, because that was the World War II generation, right? They defeated, you know, evil in the world and peace on earth. Everything afterwards is going to be wonderful. And, and to a certain extent, they, you know, many people kind of fell for that and they were living in a world which was incredibly safe to a certain extent. It was very protected and sheltered and everything else. But that also created kind of a weakness in many of these individuals and a naivety. An attitude which I think was ripe for the establishment to pry upon, I guess, to a certain extent, and fool. And then consequently, they managed to shape the world in their image, right?
Definitely, yeah. And I'd say the end of the subtitle of the book about the Great Generation, that's a topic in and of itself. Because obviously, and a lot of, you know, I've had really good discussions with people about this, and we kind of got to talk about it after my speech at Ameren last year. But Obviously, you know, if you look at the legacy of the quote-unquote greatest generation, you know, that kind of led to everything we have today. So you can certainly offer a lot of indictments of them, and obviously everything's immensely complicated. It's not like any of this stuff's cut and dry, but I guess part of that is the fact that in this Strauss-Howe generation theory, that's their idea that, you know, it cycles in this, you know, there's four permutations or iterations that are always repeating, and within their theory, the millennials are the new version of the greatest generation. It's the hero generation paradigm. So it's kind of baked into their theory, and that's kind of what, even though they created the theory, they've very much failed to clarify or address when they talk about it today. The other part of it in the book that I talk about is that regardless of the long-term legacy of the greatest generation, I'd say the greatest generation in Western Europe and America, Canada, Australia, irregardless of which side they fought on, whether they fought for the Allies or the Axis, what they were defined by was high asabaya, high kind of cultural unity. You know, these were all people that fought together, they suffered together through the Great Depression, through World War II. So regardless of what we kind of think of how everything played out, you know, looking back on it now, 80, 90 years later, there's no doubt that they all sacrificed a lot. I mean, we can, you know, have different, I mean, you know, millions upon millions of them died, you know, the Holodomor, a million things we could talk about. But their generation were people that were willing to sacrifice. They didn't kind of grow, weren't, at least in their youth, defined by this kind of materialism and, you know, sexual promiscuity that the baby boomers were. And I think that those are some of the things that a lot of rightward thinking, identitarian, you know, traditionalist millennials are kind of re-embracing is the mores and traditions or the existence of mores and traditions that defined all the generations up to the post-World War II years in the 1960s, 70s, and onward. So I guess a return to the importance of cultural and, you know, ethnic unity and ideas like that, which are totally verboten today, but which were very much accepted up until, you know, that period.
Yeah, I think there was a quote also, you know, if we look at how everything has been turned on its head, was someone who had a, excuse me, I'm knocking the mic. There was someone who had a quote on Twitter, that I came across, and I'm paraphrasing it, but it was something like, my grandfather didn't fought and die in World War II just to have liberals today calling me a Nazi for behaving like my grandfather. You know, something like that, exactly. Right? That their way of life, their lifestyle, the things that they expected to a certain extent, which was basically a government that looks after the interests of the people that are, you know, that government is responsible for, if you will, or you know, basically don't take our jobs, don't outsource everything, don't bring in tons of people and prioritize them above us and stuff like this, right? But those are the things that have now been turned on its head, that everything that they claimed that they were fighting for, everything that were values that supposedly they were defending has now been, they have let us down on those points, right? They no longer uphold those traditions that we were expected to fight, you know, to fight and die for, or our grandparents were to fight and die for. So was that just a ploy, do you think, all along to get us to give up, you know, give up on these issues so that they would slowly take over culture and win, or did this change along the way that somehow the Marxists basically took control and say, hey, we can use to a certain extent like the patriotic values and all these kinds of things in our favor? What do you think? What happened?
Yeah, I think there were definitely antecedents to cultural Marxism and progressivism alive in the world during the 1930s and 40s, certainly. But I think the vast majority of people that fought in World War II from the Allied nations would have had no idea of all the horrors that would have come to pass now and all the awful things that would be going on in a country like the UK or really, you know, all Western countries today. I think they'd all be turning over in their grave if they had known what was going to happen in places like Rotherham and Telford. If they had known even one-fifth of what would end up going on in Western Europe, I think they would have marched, you know, right back to their own capitals and done something else. But so I think that a lot of it just arose in the 1960s and after that, and the baby boomers kind of attached on to a lot of these cultural antecedents that come from, you know, the Frankfurt School, you know, Freudian psychology, a bunch of different things, Marxism. And I think since the 1960s is really where everything's been turned on its head. And I think a lot of that's just baked into the ideology. I mean, I think it's just a utopian nihilistic philosophy that values negation for its own sake. Like people always say, you know, well, how can these liberals associate and with Muslims? Because all the Muslims are against everything they stand for. And I made a video about this on the YouTube channel I just started about the fact that really it's not a contradiction when you think about it. Because, yes, even though the progressives ostensibly stand for, you know, gay rights and transgenderism and all this stuff that, you know, feminism that the Muslims are violently against, underlying all that is the fact that it all comes from this nihilistic attitude of negation for its own sake, that this cultural Marxist idea that, you know, everything we inherited was bad. The traditions were bad. The mores were bad. It was all evil patriarchy, and that we need to overturn all of it. So just like in economic Marxism where, you know, the landowning industrialist classes, you know, their power is stripped away and power is given to the proletariat. Within cultural Marxism today, the idea is that the oppressor class, which is white males like you and I, and white people broader, needs to have their power stripped away, and power needs to be given to the so-called historical victims, which is all these other myriad groups that keep developing, whether non-whites or women or gays or, you know, now transgendered people or now Muslims. So even though Islam ostensibly seems to contradict a lot of that, if you just look at it from the perspective of overturning all our traditions and mores and kind of destruction for its own sake, I think it makes a lot of sense why progressives are so supportive of Islam and Sharia courts and mass Muslim immigration and everything else.
Yeah, it's like the Sharia left, that's really what it's turned into. It's bizarre, but it does make sense because it is about the destruction of European societies. I mean, that's the end goal, and they'll use whatever group that they believe that they can control, maybe temporarily. But, you know, again, looking at this then a little bit ahead of what actually is going to happen, what the conflicts are going to be like, what the clashes are going to be like when the demographics begin to shift even more than they already have. What kind of paint that picture, if you can, for a lefty, let's say, that they think, well, we'll live in this wonderful rainbow, you know, multicultural, diverse society. Everyone will be getting along. Everyone will be, just to, you know, really be fair towards them. Maybe they think, well, of course not everyone will be the same, and there will be these differences in religion and things, right? But some overall, I think they believe that people will get along, and there will be kind of a liberal society, but you still respect, you know, the different religions, and if they have some special kind of clauses, at least if they're non-Christian, then they can still have those things, right? But what beyond that, what are we looking at? Where is this going to lead if the current trends continue of open borders and demographics?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think there's two halves to it. There's the question of, you know, what will happen to the West, to countries like the UK, Sweden, Germany, and also certainly Canada and the US, to maybe slightly less perspective. But, and then there's the question of cultural Marxism, progressivism itself, and what its future would be in the sort of utopian, very diverse society that they talk about. So I don't know the answer to what will end up happening to progressivism and cultural Marxism. I think that's a fascinating question. You could probably make an argument that, like any sort of utopian absolutist ideology, it'll end up burning itself out, sort of like the French Revolution burned itself out, sort of like ISIS has to some extent burned itself out. You could also, I think, make an argument that it's basically just sort of cultural suicide when it really comes down to it, and it'll just be displaced or sort of taken over by Islamism and Muslims, which are a much more high asabiya, you know, unified traditionalist group that still has lots of kids, that still wants to expand territory, that still cares about what their great-grandchildren will be like, and that they want lots of great-grandchildren. That isn't a suicidal ideology, but rather an expansionistic ideology. So I think, you know, probably some mix of those two things when it comes to cultural Marxism by itself. But then the question of what will happen to the West, that's one of the things I dive into in the book. And I think that Western Europe and America have two pretty different situations, because even though we both have a lot of mass immigration, etc., in America it's sort of this vast myriad of all these different groups, you know, 100 different languages spoken in some public schools in the big cities, etc., whereas in Europe it's the sort of dichotomy of where most of the immigrants, not all of them, but the vast majority seem to be Sunni Muslims within most of these countries. So it's more of this A-B dichotomy or kind of binary thing compared to America, where it's this just kind of mass ostensible melting pot. So I think the worst case scenario in America would be if either progressives, neocons, etc., come to power and basically grant amnesty to all the illegal aliens, because that would basically, I think, give complete electoral control or hegemony to the progressives for the foreseeable future. And I think that the immigration would just continue like crazy, and I think we would evolve in a direction more and more like Brazil, where it would just be higher and higher crime, less social unity, etc. America is such a giant country that it's really hard to put a finger on what might happen in America. I think the situation in America is kind of even more complicated than Europe for a lot of reasons. But I think that's kind of the worst case situation in America, is that it just kind of ends up getting more and more like Mexico or Brazil. And we see all the time now in Mexico, I mean, there's horrific, horrific things happening down there, and they don't really even have diversity, but just because it's a failed state, and kind of low asset by a country and everything else, there's a lot of horrible things happening. Now in Europe, on the other hand, what I would see happening in Western Europe and countries like Sweden, Germany, the UK, would just be the Muslims continuing to make up a bigger and bigger share of the population, obviously. Black Pigeon Speaks did a really good video, I think a year ago, where he analyzed a bunch of different demographic data and posited that by 2020 at the latest, 20 to 35-year-old native male Germans will be a minority and will be outnumbered by non-European immigrants within that 20 to 35-year-old male demographic. And I know there's various and contradictory demographic data out of Sweden, so it's hard to know what is accurate. But it seems like Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, France, the UK, Sweden are all on pretty darn bad paths demographically, because of the fact that their birth rates are so low, first of all, among the native population. The immigrant birth rates are much higher, and there doesn't seem to be much of a will within the political class towards their nation surviving. They seem to obviously be hell-bent on basically committing civilizational and cultural suicide. But I do think there is an increasing, or not necessarily increasing, I think it's always been there, but hopefully increasingly visible zeitgeist within the younger generation, or increasing resistance to the suicide of those nations. And hopefully, I mean, I think that's something we're seeing across the whole West, but I think in Europe, the best case scenarios kind of depend country by country, and there, you know, a lot of different things could happen depending on what happens, what events arise. I think if there was a economic recession, that could definitely impact the trajectory. But I think to some extent it'll be country by country, but I can't say the trajectory looks good. And I can tell you, I sure as heck wouldn't want to be a homosexual native British person in the UK 50 years from now if demographic trends continue. So,
as well, some of them have started waking up to that fact, and they've started to realize that, hey, wait a minute, you know, if this continues, you know, we'll be targeted. We'll be, you know, kind of hung in the same way that they are in the countries that many of these people they're importing came from. And so just from a survival instinct at this point, it's strange to me that many of the gays still kind of sides with Islam and stuff like that. But that's just, it's just indicative of how strong the cultural programming is, just how strong that the mind control is, that this is the right thing to do, this is good. And it's, I mean, let's face it, it is hard to stand up and speak up. It is hard to go against the flow, if you will, of culture and say, you know, I think this is bad. I think something's bad is going to happen. And just if we get into the psychology of this a little bit, most people, they just want to be, they want to be liked. They want to be, you know, popular. They want to be individuals that are popular in their own group. And that, you know, or I guess it's biological. If we don't get into that for a moment, it has to do with the fact that they want to have as much availability to them as possible when it comes to sexual partners, right? And finding their best mate and all that kind of stuff. So we're kind of hardwired into, you know, being as popular as possible and having a broad range, if you will, or availability to us. But what's happening now is, of course, that some of these people are starting to speak up against it. And it's always hard for the trailblazers to do that. They're being attacked the most. And I think we've seen a tremendous backlash against that now, too, when it comes to censorship, when it comes to blocking people, shutting them down, deplatforming them, shaming them, and all this kind of stuff. But it's, I don't know, I mean, since we last spoke, Julian, it feels like it's really in limbo, if you will. This could go either one way or the other at this point, where the populism that we're seeing, the nationalist parties and stuff like that, if we just focus on Europe for a moment, is really at a tipping point. They're right there of gaining control of their countries again. And demographically, it isn't that bad yet. And therefore, if we do it in this early stage, we could take back our countries again and take back power. Take it from these politicians that have stolen it from us without asking us, without letting us voting, you know, voting for this. They've just done it towards us. And I believe, you know, just to be in the moral debate quickly, it's a righteous cause to take back our countries. It is a moral cause. It is the right thing to do. I mean, these are injustices that have been made against us, and we have people in our countries, in European countries, that would defend any other people's right to take back their countries in the same way. Am I right?
Absolutely. That's the thing, is that if the people of these countries had been confronted with the 20-year differential at any point, you know, like Douglas Murray made a good point. He said that Enoch Powell's famous speech was only forecasting like what a modest rise in the increase in immigration when he was talking about all these bad things.
Yeah.
He said that the reality of what has occurred in the UK is about 10 times worse Enoch Powell predicted in his, you know, what's regarded as this fear-mongering speech. So it actually ended
rivers
up
of blood.
Infinitely worse. Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, what's gone on in Rotherham, Rochdale, Aylesbury, Oxford, Telford, Derby, all of these infinite now towns. If you had told the British people back in 1955 that by 2018, not only would their society be, you know, this percent foreign, Muslim, whatever that percentage is, but that in all these towns there had been thousands of 9 to 16-year-old girls gang raped by Muslim immigrants, and that it had gone on for this long, and there had been cover-ups and everything else. I believe that, obviously we can't know the exact statistics, but I mean, it seems like clearly tens of thousands at this point. And I believe, if I remember right, the author of Easy Meat Multiculturalism, which was one of the first books on Rotherham, I could have this totally wrong, but I want to say he estimated it could be over 100,000 female native British children. But irregardless of the actual number, if the British people had been told that in 1955, I mean, it seems like they would have stormed Parliament and burned everything to the ground.
Yeah.
But like you said, on a day-to-day basis, where things just change a little bit each day and people are concerned about their own families and their jobs and making money and their retirement and everything else, it is very natural to not, you know, get up in arms about this stuff, because you're focused on your own life and everything like that. So I think that that's one of the reasons it is so many young people who are very much focused on these issues, is because they're actually looking into the future and thinking about, what is life going to be like for me when I'm 60 living here? What's life going to be like for my grandchildren? And I know there's that famous statistic that most of Western Europe's leaders today are childless baby boomers. A lot of them
don't
even have children. Yep. So it's very fascinating. But yeah, I agree completely. I mean, you know, if you could suddenly have Viktor Orban be the leader of the UK, I think this problem could get cleared up pretty darn fast. I mean, it's not like things aren't able to be turned around. It's just, if there's never a change in leadership, things don't look that bright. I mean, I'm still quite optimistic though and everything like that. But, I mean, you could turn things around mighty quick if you had the political leadership to do so. But like you said, I mean, there are increasingly vast repercussions for speaking out against this stuff, as we've seen lately, as we see with Paul Golding and Jada Franson, as we see with lots of, you know, regular people in Sweden who get prosecuted for hate speech and everything else. So, yeah, there's tremendous repercussions for a lot of people who are speaking out, especially in Europe. And we have it unbelievably good, you know, here in America, because we still, for the most part, have free speech. Obviously, there's a big debate as far as within, you know, platforms like Twitter and Facebook, YouTube, everything like that. But things are nowhere near as bad as in some countries within Western Europe. But, yeah, I mean, I think that there are still countries that are kind of turning that corner. I mean, I think if we look at Austria, very, very optimistic, good, positive things are happening. And I think I wouldn't be surprised that if in 15 years Austria is more situated, aligned with the Visegrad nations, and is on a pretty darn good trajectory. And hopefully, if we're all, you know, the millions of people who don't want these things to happen in America, Canada, Western Europe, if we all kind of prosecute that resistance and that kind of metapolitical struggle to the best of our ability and have a little bit of luck, I'm still very optimistic that things can be turned around.
Yeah, actually, let's play a video. This is a new party in Sweden called Alternative for Sweden, AFS. They seem very, very interesting. There are some different options now in Sweden. Obviously, Sweden Democrats are basically helpless. They don't have this political will that you're talking about. And because I want to play this, because I want to show what some of the younger people are doing. So the guys behind this party is basically, well, primarily one guy, but a couple of years ago there was two younger guys that were thrown out of Sweden Democrats because I guess there were, I don't know all the details, but I guess they had a little bit too edgy, you know, opinions or something like that. They were showing some backbone, basically, right? That's what happened. And so let's just take a look at this trailer here. And again, for the radio audience, we're showing a translated version here. So unfortunately, you're only going to hear it in Sweden, but let's check it out. I might translate a little bit afterwards, but let's take a look.
Någon gång i framtiden kommer du att blicka tillbaka på ditt liv, hur de val du gjort. När du stod inför de beslut som betydde något, gav du då upp eller följde du din övertygelse trots att det var svårt? Kom ihåg att inget som är värt att kämpa för någonsin är enkelt. Om du ska följa dina drömmar måste du hålla huvudet högt trots allt motstånd du kommer att möta. Från de som inte har den övertygelse som du har, från de som inte vågar eller orkar tro på förändring. Sverige behöver utmanare. Människor som vågar säga sanningen, även när det är obekvämt. Människor som vet att en förändring är möjlig. Nu står du inför ett viktigt val. Du kan rösta på samma gamla politiker som aldrig lyssnar på folket och som förstör ditt land. Eller så kan du välja ett alternativ till politikerna. Ett alternativ för Sverige. När ett korrupt etablissemang säger att någonting är omöjligt, är det upp till dig att visa att de har fel. När du kämpar för något i helhet att tro på, så ger du aldrig upp. Du fortsätter framåt. Alternativ för Sverige är din rörelse. Och den 9 september har du ett val. Nu börjar resan för att ta tillbaka vårt land.
All right, so you get the idea. It's pretty good. I mean, it's a new part of just a couple of days old, really. I don't know if you've seen it before, but it's playing off of the alternative for Deutschland, right? Alternative for AfD in Germany. But it shows a little bit of this different. It maybe has some of these millennial qualities that you're talking about, right? It's a fine balance. Like, I just want to say this quickly. That it was like, oh, well, they're cucking or they're not doing this or that, whatever. It's like, you know, ordinary people out there, and correct me if I'm wrong, Julian, say what you think about this, but ordinary people out there, they still need something which is fairly palatable, that you're not going to get the majority and the masses rushing for something which is like super edgy and you know, the people still want something which is fairly kind of contained, if you will, but it needs to be enough challenging to the establishment that people are also drawn to it. So it is a fine balance, and we'll see if this is successful or not, but I'm still encouraged that these options are popping up. I don't know, have you seen it before, this one?
I was aware of the party's formation recently. I had not seen that video. It's an awesome video. It's very edifying. I thought that was great, and that's definitely very promising that there is a new party like that in Sweden. But yeah, I agree completely. That's why I'm always extremely hesitant to ever kind of criticize anyone or say, oh, they're cucking, or oh, they're not saying this right. I mean, first of all, we're all imperfect people trying to, you know, contribute in our own different ways. Second of all, I mean, you know, obviously me as an American, it's like my contribution or suffering for, you know, trying to fight for any of this is minuscule compared to these people in Europe who are actually, you know, going to jail and, you know, have being blackballed from employment and everything else. So, I mean, even if I did kind of violently disagree with them, I wouldn't want to criticize them. But in addition, beyond just that, you're absolutely right. I mean, you need a spectrum of people kind of giving a message in different ways or in different wavelengths, because of the vast myriad of people who are kind of not yet awakened to all this are all going to kind of, you know, find different entry points based on their own personalities, kind of where they are on their own political journey. So, you know, even if everybody who, you know, wanted mass immigration to stop in Europe or wanted repatriation to occur, who, you know, wanted Europe, U.S., Canada to kind of survive or go along this trajectory, you know, even if they could all agree completely or have the exact same views, I wouldn't want them to, because I think it's valuable for, you know, different people to be approaching it different. And one way I like to put it sometimes is that it can be very valuable to be kind of outside the Overton window pulling people outward, but it can be equally valuable to be inside the Overton window kind of pushing the side of it outward. So I think there needs to be kind of a bunch of different messages and people at different points of the journey or different beliefs, everything like that. And I think as long as people are kind of opposing this ideology of suicide, then I'm always inclined to view them as an ally.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, again, the video, just for those who just heard the radio version of the show, not watching it, you know, they're talking about basically, you know, taking back Sweden. It's a lot of the you know, familiar tone that we're familiar with. But the willingness of the party, and they're talking about the difficult choice of going against the grain. You know, on one hand, you want to point out the corrupt establishment, but then there is a threat of ostracization within that. But you have to, you know, basically, if you want to do something which is important in your life, you have to stand up for it. You have to follow those beliefs and basically make those tough decisions, because that's what it's about. I think I've said this on other shows, but it's basically like, either we take hard, tough decisions now, or we face catastrophe down the line where the suffering is going to be immensely more difficult than the potentiality that we lose a couple of friends or some family gets upset with us and we might, you know, lose our job or something. And although that those are, you know, very important like aspects in the here and now, in the long term and in the survival of our people in the future generations, those sacrifices are nothing, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, certainly I think that if there's not a little bit of or moderate amount of turbulence and fluidity that we all go through now to put things back on track, you know, in all the countries across the West, for the most part, Western Europe, U.S., Canada, Australia, etc., there's going to be way, way, way more turbulence and bad stuff later on. I mean, if you think about it, I can't think of any countries on earth where, you know, 85% of the population is Islamic, where the other 10 or 15% doesn't have a pretty horrid, wretched existence. So the idea that, you know, a country is just going to keep importing Muslim immigrants for decades and decades on end and not having enough children to replace themselves, etc., and that things aren't eventually going to end up being quite horrific is ludicrous. And to go back to what you said a minute ago, I think you're absolutely right that caring about this stuff, there's nothing edgy or intentionally provocative inherently about caring about this stuff. Caring about this stuff is the most natural, normal, healthy thing in the world. You know, the extreme ideology is this ideology of suicide and that we see emanating from the capitals of, you know, the EU, Western Europe, Justin Trudeau's government, you know, a lot of the liberals in the U.S., etc. So that's definitely something. I you know, when I first started focusing on a lot of this, I think there's often a subconscious urge, because you get so frustrated with what's going on that you end up being a little bit more angry or provocative or extreme than if you were really having a very sincere kind of in-person conversation with someone where you were trying to be diplomatic. But I'm trying to kind of do the opposite now, like with this new YouTube channel and everything. I'm trying to be very, yeah, I guess more the same way I would be as if I was talking to someone in real life in front of me who I disagreed with but wanted to have a respectful conversation with. Because I feel like I'm a pretty stinking normal guy. You know, I have a wife. I have a 5-year-old son. I, you know, was always into sports growing up. I used to run a mental health provider. Now I own a couple of small businesses. I'm about the most normal guy in the world. And I think that caring about this stuff, not being ashamed to be white, not wanting Sweden, Norway, where all my ancestors are from, to commit civilizational suicide, not wanting the U.S. to import tens of millions of people from all over the world until we no longer have a unified culture or language, is the most normal, rational, healthy thing on earth. And I think it's important to really state it that way, that, hey, there's nothing intentionally provocative about this. This isn't being, you know, transgressive for transgression's sake. This is having a normal, healthy attitude in the face of a radical, utopian, insane ideology of suicide that has somehow taken control of so many Western countries.
Yeah, definitely. It's survival also. It's an instinctual, you know, response to a threat against, you know, your very survival. And so, again, to have a natural response to that is to want to do something about it and fight back and pushing back. And it's frankly amazing that it's, I mean, I know that we've always had a level of opposition, but an organized opposition is now slowly taking shape, and it's amazing that's taken so long, if I'm being honest, which shows how tolerant we are. We're so tolerant that we are actually, we're tolerating the intolerable, I think I said once, and that's what it is. I mean, it is an intolerable situation. No other people anywhere, no other country would accept these changing conditions that we're facing. But let's take a short break here, just a few minutes, and I want to continue talking more about this. We're going to get into Jordan Peterson, talk a bit more about the millennials, how you see this shift taking place and what they could do and what shape this is going to take itself. But you were plugging the YouTube channel, so let's talk about that a little bit more. And then I want you to plug the book as well, Identity Rising, How Nationalist Millennials Will Retake Europe, Save America, and Become the New Greatest Generation. Where are the copies of the book available, Julian?
Wonderful. Yeah, people can get on Amazon.com and just type my name in, Julian Langness, and it should pop up. I think it just came out a few days ago, so usually Amazon takes a few days to merge the book title and the author profile. So if you don't see it right away, just research my name or just type in Identity Rising. But yeah, title is Identity Rising, How Nationalist Millennials Will Retake Europe, Save America, and Become the New Greatest Generation, which is admittedly a somewhat optimistic title, but mostly serious title.
You have
title.
To be optimistic.
Yes, absolutely.
We can't be like, yeah, we'll see what happens. You know, this is yeah. We're in for this for the win. There's no other option. There's no other way out of it. That's just the reality of it. We're going to win this thing, you know, or we're going to die. That's just the reality of it, you
absolutely.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, Identity Rising, it's on Amazon, and then you can check out my new YouTube channel. I just created it about 3 weeks ago, and it's called Conquering Modernity. So just type in Conquering Modernity on YouTube, and then you can also find me on Twitter and Gab at Julian Langness or J_Langness.
All right, cool. We'll add some links to that. The YouTube channel, of course, Conquering Modernity, a couple of videos there for you, well, more than a couple, but you know, it's fairly new started channel, as you said, so I'm looking forward to more content there. We'll add a link to the book as well, guys, so definitely check it out if you're interested. Support Julian's work if you want to read up on it and basically go through the book. Check out this previous book too, by the way, Fist Fights with the Muslims in Europe. We talked about that. There's a show in the archive for you to check out. But all right, we'll just take a quick short break. We'll be back in the member section. Stay tuned, everyone. All right, ladies and gentlemen, please join us in the second hour as we continue with Julian Langness, discuss strategy, discuss how to move forward, discuss engagement in the activism and politics and all the things, all the problems that we're facing, how to get people engaged in that, whether that's millennials or boomers or those in between or whatever it happens to be. Great discussion coming up, so if you do want to check it out, please head on over to redicemembers.com, our members' website. That's how we support ourselves. Without memberships, without you guys signing up, we can't continue doing what we're doing. So thank you for your support, and also thank you for understanding the importance of helping us out in this time. We don't have any great sponsors or ads. We don't have big financiers behind us or anything like that. We're doing this solely with your help. So thank you so much for believing in what we're doing and helping us at this crucial time. All right, well, we'll be right back after a short break. RedIceMembers.com. We'll see you there. Talk to you after the break.